On the 27th of March, the Coffee House Shots team will be joined by special guests to give you their take on a spring statement. We will be live on stage at London's Cadogan Hall. To get your tickets today, visit spectator.co.uk/springstatementlive. We'll see you there. Hello and welcome to the Edition podcast from The Spectator, where each week we shed a little light on the thought process behind putting the world's oldest weekly magazine to bed. I'm Lara Prendergast, The Spectator's executive editor.
And I'm William Moore, The Spectator's features editor. On this week's podcast, what Trump really wants from Ukraine, the women being pushed towards sterilisation by the NHS, and what makes something so bad that it's good.
I'm talking about the kind of diplomacy that's going to end the destruction of your country.
Yes, but if you are not strong...
Mr. President, with respect, I think it's disrespectful for you to come into the Oval Office and try to litigate this in front of the American media. Right now, you guys are going around and forcing conscripts to the front lines because you have manpower problems. You should be thanking the President for trying to bring it into this conflict.
Have you ever been to Ukraine that you say what problems we have?
From the success of Keir Starmer's visit to Washington to the squabbling in the Oval Office with Zelensky, we have seen the good, the bad, and the ugly of geopolitics in the last week, say Neil Ferguson and Nicholas Cumleben in this week's cover piece. They argue that what President Trump is really concerned about when it comes to Ukraine is rare earth minerals, which they believe Ukraine has in abundance under its soil. The conventional wisdom is that the US is desperately short of these critical minerals. And as Neil and Nicholas point out, Trump is driven by a nagging sense of inferiority in comparison to the rare minerals powerhouse, China. Neil and Nicholas joined us earlier to discuss. I started by asking them both, now we're a month in to Trump's second term, what differences they've noticed between the first term and the second so far.
Well, the most obvious difference is that they didn't expect to win in 2016 and had to throw together an administration of Trump campaign people like Steve Bannon, then Republican establishment figures and generals. And two out of those three groups were hostile to the president's agenda. So that was the reason for all the fire and fury that you'll remember. Constant infighting, leaks, and outright undermining of what Trump was trying to do, which drove him to distraction. Trump 2.0 is profoundly different. A, they expected to win and spent a long time planning so that pretty much all the executive orders were prefigured in the campaign and worked out by not so much heritage by the America First people. And then the administration is staffed not so much by loyalists, I think that's sometimes said and isn't quite right, by people who are unorthodox the way Trump is and owe their elevation to him. And so this strange administration with all kinds of unlikely figures is far more united than the first Trump administration. They differ. There are debates, pretty lively ones on foreign policy issues, but they're not spilling over into the media in an acrimonious way in the way that they did in Trump 1. I'll add one final point. The president has vastly greater confidence than he had when he first was in the White House. And not only has he done the job before, but he's had 4 years to think what to learn from the mistakes of the first term, which only one previous president, Grover Cleveland, had the luxury of. So he's older, but he's, I hesitate to say it, wiser. He's certainly more familiar with the pitfalls of this job.
Nick, in your piece this week, you lay out this minerals deal, which seems to be on the table right now. Could you start by explaining to listeners what it would include and what these minerals are that are in question and why they are so important?
Thank you, Lara. Happy to. What the deal would include is America taking a share, likely 50%, of all new natural resource revenues from projects in Ukraine, not just minerals. To call this a minerals deal doesn't fully account for its breadth. It would also include hydrocarbons, so oil and gas. And in terms of what that actually means, the answer is nobody quite knows, because Ukraine hasn't done a proper geological survey since it was part of the Soviet Union. We know a little bit more about the oil and gas because there's a well-developed industry there. But most of the existing projects that make sense have already been exploited by local Ukrainian players and by some foreign companies. If we think about the rare earth dimension, as President Trump puts it, Ukraine may well have some rare earths, but rare earths aren't actually rare. They're extremely common. It's just rare to find them in quantities that make sense to recover, given the price on which they sell at global markets. What's more, a majority of Ukraine's rare earths are in parts of Ukraine that Russia controls. So good luck. Good luck putting American flags, American engineers, and American companies there, especially when Vladimir Putin wants to strike his own rare earths for strategic initiative deal.
And do you think Donald Trump is aware of all of this, but he still wants to push this deal through, clearly?
I would be surprised. The number of people who understand the difference between rare earths and critical minerals is a very, very small slice of the population. I doubt it includes the president. He seems to be taking a real estate developer's attitude to this kind of negotiation, where you start with a maximalist position. That served him very well, both in his professional life and in his public service career. But it can't put minerals in the ground that don't exist there today.
Also, if you notice, he called them raw earths in his famously stormy meeting with Volodymyr Zelensky, which didn't suggest an expert-level grasp on the subject.
Well, Neil, on that now infamous meeting, which you just mentioned, people often say that the art of the deal is knowing when to walk away from the table. Now that Trump subsequently has halted American aid to Ukraine, it does seem like he is at least willing to consider walking away. How is that going to affect the relationship between America and its allies, such as Britain? What kind of waters are we heading into here?
People seem very confused in London, in Berlin, in Brussels. I don't think the coverage has been very good, because what was clearly supposed to happen last Friday was that Zelensky was supposed to come in and sign the agreement that Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, had figured out with him. And as Nick says, this agreement wasn't really like the deal of a lifetime. There is not gold in Nemnar Hills or much in the way of real mineral value, but it was a symbolic deal that would commit the United States to the economic development and reconstruction of Ukraine. Zelensky complained, not unreasonably, that this was not sufficient to give Ukraine security. Trump's position was it's enough. If we're there, if Americans are there extracting the raw earths or rare earths or whatever you call them, that's enough. And Zelensky's response was, it's not. Not with the Russians next door. We need security guarantees. And that was where the meeting blew up. He should not have said any of that with the cameras rolling, but he forgot the fundamental point that we quote from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. There are two kinds of people in this world, my friend, those with loaded guns and those who dig. And what he had to do was dig. He had to just sign the document. Instead, he decided to have a full-blown row with the President of the United States and the Vice President of the United States, with the Secretary of State sitting all looking like he'd swallowed a lemon. This was stupid. I mean, the art of the deal is not getting kicked out of the Oval Office, as Zelensky was, and then having your military aid and intelligence support from the United States cut off, plunging Ukraine's defenses into a meaningful crisis. So I look at this as primarily a blunder by Zelensky. The European position, which has evolved extraordinarily rapidly, is, oh, we are going to have to provide the security guarantees because the Americans are not. This has finally sunk in. What Trump achieved in the last 2 weeks was finally to convince the Europeans that they cannot free ride on American contributions to NATO anymore, that if they want Ukraine to have security guarantees, they will have to provide them, because all America is providing is the minerals deal. And that's where Keir Starmer and Emmanuel Macron come in, who'd also been on the reality TV show in the Oval Office. Their problem is that they now need to step up to take the place of the United States immediately, but also in the long term, if Ukraine is to have any future. And it's interesting just how quickly the Europeans have moved. I mean, the Germans have just agreed to a massive change in their fiscal regime to increase defense spending. The European Commission is announcing hundreds of billions of euros of additional spending. I mean, if Trump's objective was to get the Europeans finally to take responsibility for European security, he achieved it. And it's eluded presidents since Richard Nixon. So you can't get away from the fact that if that's the point of all this, Trump has been successful. The difficulty for Starmer and Macron and all the other European leaders is that they do not have strategic autonomy and they lack the capability to substitute for the United States in the short term. And that was where Zelensky really forgot himself. Sure, he's loved, adored, welcomed, not only into presidential palaces, he even gets to go to royal palaces. But no European is a substitute for the US when it comes particularly to military hardware, satellite, intelligence, all of that stuff. The Europeans don't have it. Zelensky's put Ukraine in a very weak position.
Nick, one of the overall points to your piece is that China and America are locked in this battle for control over various minerals. What do you think China would make of this potential deal that America would like to strike?
I think they'd probably look at the points we've made around Ukraine's mineral potential and smile, perhaps laugh. Ukraine is not a major producer of any minerals today, beyond one form of titanium, which primarily goes into the white paint. As far as I can tell, neither the Chinese government nor the US government considers white paint critical. What China is doing around the world is locking up supply of genuinely important minerals, lithium, cobalt, copper, and that's really where China has created this immense strategic monopoly on mineral supply, and more importantly, mineral processing. What that allows China to do is not only become the world's leading producer of key inputs like solar panels, electric vehicles, transformers, and other key economic goods, but it's given China a real foothold in a number of strategically important countries across Latin America and Africa. To some extent, this US-Ukraine deal, if it happens, will give the US some of that strategic grounding, but it's not going to solve the economic problem. And I doubt it'll raise anyone's blood pressure in Beijing.
Neil, just finally, I'm very interested in something that you have said in a recent interview. You said that the Ukraine war is the Korean War of Cold War II. Could you explain what you mean by that and perhaps what other lessons we could take from history when trying to make sense of what might happen next in this extremely precarious feeling time?
Well, I've been saying since 2018, as Nick knows, that we're in Cold War II. The People's Republic of China has taken the place of the Soviet Union. It's the only other superpower. And what we were just talking about, the contest for critical minerals, is a classic Cold War contest. Just as the contest for artificial intelligence or quantum computing or dominance in space, all of these things are going on right now. In just the same way that the United States raced the Soviet Union into space and for nuclear dominance, so the US and China are in a multifaceted race for technological and economic supremacy. In the first Cold War, it took Americans a while to realize they were in it. And it wasn't really until the Korean War broke out in 1950 that it was clear that the world was in a major ideological collision. I think in the same way, Russia's invasion of Ukraine 3 years ago caused the scales to fall from many people's eyes, especially when it became apparent that the invasion had been given a green light by Xi Jinping and that China has been the principal source of economic support for the Russian war effort, including all kinds of dual-use technology, semiconductors, etc., without which Putin's war machine would never have been able to sustain a three-year war. What's interesting about this argument is that it implies, and always did imply, what Ukraine's fate would likely be, that there would not be a Ukrainian victory, but nor would there be a Russian one, that there would be an impasse at some point, the war would cease to be a war of movement, become a war of attrition, and then there would be not a peace, there's never been a peace in the Korean War, but a ceasefire and then a stabilization of a very dangerous frontier. That is a plausible scenario and has been all along, that Ukrainians would get to keep 80% of the territory and have a shot at economic reconstruction, which for South Korea was one of the big success stories of the Cold War, maybe the biggest success story of any economy coming out of complete devastation in 1953 and going on to become one of the Asian tigers and an OECD member. It's an amazing story. Also transforming from a dictatorship to a successful democracy. That could be Ukraine's future if Trump gets this right in the negotiation that he wants to lead to at least a ceasefire. The problem is, and I said this to President Zelensky's advisors in September 2022, there's also a scenario where you're South Vietnam. And in the case of South Vietnam, the problem was that not only did the American troops depart, but also the American aid was cut off because Congress essentially cut South Vietnam off in the mid-70s, so that there was no way of sustaining South Vietnam once the North Vietnamese unleashed their final and decisive offensive. So that's the nightmare scenario. Again, it's a Cold War analogy, but in the case of South Vietnam, it was impossible to keep South Vietnam going as an independent state because there were no security guarantees. This is Zelensky's nightmare, that 2 years after some kind of deal is done, the Russians are marching into Kyiv the way the North Vietnamese marched into Saigon in 1975. And this is why the key to all of this is providing Ukraine with some kind of security guarantee that will translate, I think, into non-Ukrainian troops in Ukraine. We now know they will not be US troops. That was never likely. But the Europeans have learned what they had been in denial about for 3 years. They were in denial about the fact that at some point they would own Ukraine. And they have now got to face that reality. And that means they're going to have to provide the boots on the ground, which is going to be tough. I mean, Sir Keir Starmer talks a good game, but how big is the British Army these days? You send a bunch of soldiers to provide a backstop in Ukraine, to use a Starmer expression. There's not many left back in the UK or for any other use. So the Ukrainians need that kind of security. They need a substitute for Uncle Sam. What the European leaders now have to figure out, along with Keir Starmer, is how they can come up with it.
Next, why are women having cesareans being offered sterilization? Flora Watkins writes a piece for the magazine this week in which she recounts how, during a routine antenatal operation, she was blindsided by the opening gambit from her obstetrician, who asked if she would like her tubes tied while they got the baby out. Flora was quite shocked by the unsolicited offer, and for the piece, spoke to other women who were distressed and confused by similar unsolicited offers from doctors. Most of them felt it was a judgment on the number of children that they should have. So where does this policy come from and who is it for? Flora joined me to discuss further, along with Dr. Janet Barter, president of the Faculty of Sexual and Reproductive Healthcare, which advises women on contraception. Flora, could you start by just walking our listeners through this antenatal appointment that you attended, which inspired your piece this week?
Well, it was, gosh, it's getting on for 6 years ago, but I can still remember it so clearly. That particular appointment had been arranged to discuss pain relief after C-section, because there had been such an abject lack of pain relief after having my first two children. It was just appalling. And I do think it was a factor in me getting a really filthy dose of postnatal depression, sort of having to beg for morphine on the postnatal ward and being discharged with paracetamol and ibuprofen, so that I ended up going into A&E to get pain relief. I mean, this is a whole other scandal in women's healthcare. So I went with my husband, who'd taken the morning off work to come with me, and sat down. And the obstetrician, it was the first time I'd met her, and she launched into, so this is your third child, why don't we tie your tubes while you're open on the table? And it took me a little while for my brain to catch up with what was coming out of her mouth. I said, what? What? And she said it again. And then I actually swore at her. I was like, what is this? What's going on here? And she just wouldn't let it drop. I mean, if a woman tells you to F off, when you offer to sterilize her, I mean, I would just drop it straight away. But she just kept coming back and back and back. Nothing was mentioned about safety. It just felt like a judgment on, you've got three children, that's more than enough. And my husband, I was so exercised about it. I remember the baby going ballistic, kicking me. I was so stressed. I was quite frightened because it just felt like a sort of state attempt to get me. It wasn't an offer, it was pressure to agree to sterilization. I remember my husband saying to her, she's told you 4 or 5 times no. And then she changed tack and said, well, let's pop a Moreno coil in at the same time. I don't want one. And then I can't remember how this ended. We then eventually, after maybe a good 10 minutes, got onto the subject of why we were there, which was she needs morphine post C-section written into her birth plan.
So then, as you recount in the piece, you sort of go on a bit of a hunt, I suppose, to find out where this policy came from, sort of why you had this experience that you had. What did you discover?
Well, it just felt so totally weird and strange. I met up with a friend shortly before we had our babies who was having her third child as well. And we were walking through the park with takeaway coffees, and Tess said to me, can you believe, it was her first C-section, she had to have it for medical reasons. The consultant said to me, she was at a neighbouring hospital in South London, it's your third child, why don't we tie your tubes while you're on the table? And I just stopped and said, oh my God, that happened to me. And then we had our babies. My daughter was very ill when she was born. We were very quickly after she came home into the lockdowns. So it wasn't something I ever raised. I mean, frankly, I had much bigger things to sort out. But it's always bothered me. It's always been there in my peripheral vision. And my daughter went to primary school last year. And I happened to mention it to one of my commissioning editors at The Spectator. And she was like, that's appalling. Can you look into it? So then I posted something on social media very quickly, had, I think, 7 or 8 case studies, good geographical spread, ranging from 20 years ago until one woman I know, the baby's not been born yet. And all were asked, two of the women only had their second child. Three were in their 30s, 36, 37, all being asked and felt huge pressure to agree to being sterilized.
Dr. Barta, what do you make of Flora's experience? Is this something that you've had women come to you and speak about, this particular issue?
Actually not. And so I've really valued the chance to have conversations about this, because I think it's been very thought-provoking for me, and just so sad that this is the way it turned out. So I think, for me, this is all about communication. So, you know, we believe at the Faculty of Sexual and Reproductive Healthcare, you know, we are all about women being able to make their own choices of contraception, if and when and what they want to use, but also having access to it. And we know that access is more and more difficult. So we believe that there should be a conversation about contraception, but it should be much, much earlier in the pregnancy. It should be for everybody. And it should be, what are you thinking? What are your plans? What would you like, if anything? This is all of the options. You know, you can think about pills, condoms, implants, coils, sterilization if you finish your family. But it should never be that a woman feels pressured. It should be about a genuine, equal conversation to give the woman a chance to think about what she wants to do, if anything. And it should never be, you know, at that stage. I mean, at least it sounds like this wasn't just before you walked into the room to have your cesarean section, which I know can happen. But, you know, for me, it should be before 20 weeks. It should be much, much earlier. And I think we do have a tendency, I think, in medicine to, when a woman is pregnant, to sort of, you know, forget that she had a before the pregnancy and forget that she's got an after the pregnancy. And all we think about is the pregnancy. And of course, that's ridiculous, isn't it? Because, you know, you go home with your baby and you live your life, and you've got to be prepared for all of that as well. So I think we've got to look at the life course approach a lot more than we do. But what worries me most about this is the sense that you felt pressured. I think, you
and
know,
she wouldn't let it drop. So imagine if English wasn't your first language, or you weren't as confident as me. Imagine. And what was common to every single case study, not a single one of us had said, we don't want any more children. It was just assumed that we had enough.
Well, it hadn't even been asked, in fact, by the sound of it.
No, hadn't been asked.
So Flora, that's a very interesting part of your piece, I think, is do you think that there's a sort of assumption perhaps now among said medical professionals?
No. Oh, God.
That you should want to stop having children after a certain number.
This is not the first doctor who had been extremely negative about having more than two children. So I have seen for years, I've been on the books of the pain consultant at the same trust. I had a very bad riding accident when I was a teenager, which smashed my pelvis, and I've got a scoliosis of crooked spine as a result, which was the reason I had sections in the first place. And with age, I've had various problems like slipped discs, and there's some arthritic changes. And I did go and see her, I think before I was pregnant with my daughter, or when I was trying to get pregnant again, just to ask, if I have a flare-up of pain, can I take cocodamol? Because we want another baby. And she rolled her eyes, and I was like, what, you don't think I should be having another one? And she actually said, most people would say that two is enough. I'm like, what? I've got two boys. I always thought I'd have a bigger family. I was actually desperate for a daughter, but I wanted a third child. But it's just breathtaking.
Dr. Barta, I would love your opinion. Obviously, as you say, there's been a horrible kind of communication, at the very least, between the doctors that Flora's seen and Flora. But is there any medical evidence to suggest that after a certain amount of cesareans, that there start to become medical risks involved?
Just before I say that, though, before I forget, I do think when you say, imagine if you didn't speak English or you weren't as confident as you were, all the studies that have been done and all the surveys that have been done have a theme of women not feeling listened to. So, you know, in the same way that you weren't listened to in terms of your future pregnancy planning, I see women who want to be sterilized and are told, no, you're too young, you can't do it, you know, you might change your mind. So I think the theme here is, for me, I've not come across the sense of doctors thinking that two children is enough or judging women who have more children than that. But obviously, you know, I do work in a different world now. I work in a world of sexual and reproductive health care. But I do think we hear all the time that women don't feel listened to. And I think that's really important. In terms of the cesarean sections, yes, there is evidence the operation becomes more complex each time you do it. There are risks. The biggest risk, which is a small risk, but there is a risk, and hopefully, Flora, this was all talked about, there is a risk of what we call placenta accreta, where the placenta can embed into the cesarean section scar. And therefore, it's not possible to deliver the placenta, and that can cause no end of problems. But it's really important not to scare women who have cesarean sections, because that's a very serious complication, but it's also very rare. So it's important when a woman is giving consent for an operation that you understand, and I'm sure that you did and you do, the risks, but it's your job to assess the risks. It's not anybody else's job to tell you what to do or what not to do.
I have always felt, I had my first child has just turned 11, that I was far safer having an elective section than being on a poorly staffed labour ward attempting to give birth naturally. And now, is it more than half maternity wards are deemed unsafe? It's absolutely terrifying.
Yeah, and I couldn't comment on that because obviously I don't work in maternity now, but we do know exactly as you say, the cesarean section rate is very variable from one place to another, and it is increasing. So at the moment, it varies between about 35% and about 52% from one hospital, one area to another. So it is very, very common to have a cesarean section, and I think we all need to feel safe, don't we? And I think if a woman feels that the safest thing for her and her baby to, is to have something planned and predictable, which is a cesarean section, then nowadays, most, possibly not all, but most obstetricians would absolutely respect that.
And just finally, Flora, when you set about to do your piece and you made all these phone calls and so on, did you ever, in the end, get either an explanation or an apology for your experience?
I had an apology from the trust, but I had a lot of sort of mealy-mouthed, wishy-washy statements from various trusts. But I kept, everything kept pointing me back to the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, which is who I contacted in the first place and wouldn't speak to me and put me on to Dr. Barter. He was brilliant. But then I had a brainwave. Because of my daughter had this horror start to life where she was very ill, I did have to go in for a debrief with the obstetrician who had offered me sterilization. And I had her phone number saved on my phone, so I called her. I didn't tell her it was for this, which is why we've anonymized her on the trust. But I was like, I need closure on this. Where did it come from? And where's this policy come from? And she said it's not a policy, but she did say, I'm sure I've seen it in Royal College guidance. And she said, it's also from what we've learned from our predecessors. So I went back to the Royal College and said, look, I've had now a consultant obstetrician say they think it came from you. And they eventually came out with a statement saying that sterilization should be offered, I think, if a woman has expressed desire that her fertility be ended. But as I said at the outset of this conversation, not a single one of us had expressed that.
And it doesn't sound as if any of you were offered any other method of contraception apart from that coil at the last minute.
Which again, I mean, this is 6 years ago. We were still being told then that coils weren't painful to insert or remove. You know, that has changed now. I very much didn't want one for all sorts of reasons. One, I wanted another. I didn't think I'd finished having children. And also, friends of mine had horrendous problems with them. I mean, one friend of mine, this is so grim, it's almost assault. She was pulled down the bed as they tried to remove it. Then it's not, I don't think, a very pleasant or safe form of contraception.
Well, and it's what's right for you that matters. So, you know, after lots of explanation and choices and in the right hands, many women will choose that as a method of contraception, but it should never be pressurized. And I do hear women saying, I was told that's what I've got to have. And that's never right.
And finally, in this week's issue, Sam Leith, our literary editor, celebrates William McGonagall, the man affectionately considered the world's worst poet. So, is there joy to be found in bad poetry? That's the case that Sam makes in this week's issue. And to discuss, we were joined by Sam and one of the more successful Dundonian poets, Don Peterson. I started by asking Sam to tell us about his lasting fascination with William McGonagall.
Well, I think just as I was a teenager, I was, you know, very interested in poetry and I was reading a lot. And you know, if you're kind of roaming around the field of poetry in a slightly clueless way, eventually you'll sort of stub your toe against McGonagall. And my dad had in his bookshelf, not one actually, but two copies of McGonagall's Poetic Gems, which I've got this attractively kind of tartan upholstered edition. And McGonagall's sort of sublimely funny, because he gets sort of everything wrong and yet is convinced he's this great poet. So he's a kind of caution to anybody who thinks poetry is easy to do. You know, and I'm sure Don will have, you know, wiser and more penetrating things to say on the subject. But I think there's something about bad poetry that tells you a bit about the good sort as well.
Don, I would love your opinions on that. Particularly, I suppose, how is the threshold crossed between something that is just bad and something that is so bad it becomes sort of brilliant again?
I'm not sure it's that circular route where they join up at the back. I think it remains bad and just gets worse. I mean, if you track Poetic Gems through its various iterations, there are many other volumes, Sam. There's things like More Poetic Gems and Even More Poetic Gems. And
still really, more poetic.
It's hard
gems.
To imagine, but it's diminishing. but I should say my feelings are complex because he's a fellow Dundonian. I use fellow loosely. So, I mean, I and other Dundee poets like W.N. Herb, John Glendy, always kind of assumed that if we could write a decent haiku and avoid any major assault in the language, we'd get a small triumphal arch at least. But you know, they have a statue of McGonagall instead. So I find it hard to talk about him with much equanimity. But it's, but yeah, he was bad. You know, it's just like, but obviously, it's a bit more complex than that. He was writing within a kind of Scottish-Irish broadside balladeer tradition as well, where he felt obliged to respond to the events of the day. And to that degree, I find some of his enterprise quite admirable. But no, it was absolutely shockingly bad, let's not. You know, I'm fueled by this bomb-proof kind of ego, you know? Sam will know the story about him getting the fake award of the White Elephant of Burma.
I do know this. The Balmoral story is where he writes off asking Queen Victoria for her patronage and gets a polite rejection letter from a flunky, and on the strength of that, trudges 3 days on foot to Balmoral and he'd be turned away at the gate by the said packing. You know,
his accreditation was this fake award that people had given him, you know, sort of the Grand Knight of the Holy Order of the White Elephant, and he thought it was genuine, and changed his middle name to Topaz, you know. I remember this morning, there's this thing about, I don't know if you know the story about Henri Rousseau, you know, sort of, you know, the great naive French painter, and he accidentally got an academic award that was for another Henri Rousseau and just kept it. And he had painted himself, you know, sort of wearing the thing. Well, it was brilliant, just to double down on the whole thing.
Sam, in your piece, you reference some of William's poetry. Do you have a particular favourite? Might you do us the honour and read us an extract?
I don't know. I mean, I think Don would be the better one to read, given that he has the accent and I don't. Because, you know, as Don rightly says, McGonagall was writing in a kind of Scottish vernacular balladeering tradition.
Sure, Sam. Don, would you be happy to read?
I have nothing before me. I could probably do a small, you know, bit from memory. You know, the Tay Bridge disaster is...
That's the classic, isn't
it? Oh, yes.
If
you can do the opening stanza or so of...
It's something like, oh, beautiful bridge over the silvery Tay, at last I am very sorry to say the 89 lives have been taken away on this last Sabbath day of 1879, which will be remembered for a very long time.
So, Don, you said there's a statue to McGonagall in Dundee. So it sounds like Dundonians are rather proud of him. They're happy to lay claim to him.
Yeah, but I mean, you're talking about a city, you know, whose major achievements were the reverse gear and the non-adhesive postage stamp. I mean, this is just what we're doing, Dundee, you know. I mean, it's perverse, you know. It's a silly person to have a statue of, you know.
But don't you think there's something very endearing? I mean, so Sam, you say this in your piece, that there's a sort of bathos to McGonagall that makes him very likable, not just despite his badness, but because of it. And there's something, it becomes almost quite endearing, the badness and the self-delusion together.
Well, the argument I think I try to make is he's very, there's a sort of ingenuousness to him that he's not... You know, there's no sort of side or, you know, he's so heroically unself-aware that creates an effect of its own. And that thing of bathos, that kind of, you know, clunking, you know, solemnity with which something very banal is said. I mean, that's a poetic technique that could be used. And I mentioned Stevie Smith. You know, Stevie Smith, you know, was wonderful at using bathos and was wonderful at using these sort of skittering lines that collapse into prose. But she did so knowingly, and McGonagall sort of does so unknowingly. But I mean, there's like in his memoirs, you know, he has this lovely sort of unself-awareness where he'll say, for example, you know, he's got a reminiscence of publicans, he's known. He says, you know, the first man who ever threw peas at me was a publican. And it's like, he just passes over the fact that implied is obviously that many people since have thrown peas at him. And he doesn't think this is an unusual state of affairs at all. You know,
I should say hot peas is a very Dundonian thing to throw. It's just the tradition that is subsequently kept up.
Well, they stick.
Yeah. I just, when Sam was talking there about the fact that, you know, so you can productively sort of play with, you know, doggerel traditions in ways that make art. Another good example of that would be a poem of Elizabeth Bishop's called Large Bad Picture, which is a kind of a tribute to amateurism and naive art done in the style of a naive poem. Which is quite brilliant.
She never wrote a bad poem. I mean, she's the sort of anti-McGonagall, isn't she?
She is, yeah. The universe would end if they'd ever met now.
Sam, from a technical point of view, what is it that McGonagall keeps getting wrong, or does he sort of get everything wrong?
Well, I mean, again, we're in the presence of one of the great theoretical technicians of verse, but I would say for the sake, he's just got this incredible tinier. I mean, he simply cannot hear the quantity of any you know, single foot he puts down, and he, which is why, and it adds to the bathos effect, that like that last line of the opening quatrain of the Tay Bridge disaster, where he said, you know, which will be remembered for a very long time. You know, that's pure prose. There's no way to make that scan. And he's writing in a tradition which is very, you know, kind of formally quite rigid, which has these very strong end rhymes, which has a kind of, you know, he knew rhyme. He knew that you had to rhyme, but rhyme was something you had to hit with a hammer. And you'd approach the rhyme with a random number of syllables with the stresses all over the place. And he gets that wrong so often. And, you know, he chucks two or three extra syllables into a line with such, you know, insouciant abandon that it's a sort of anti-genius, I think. I know, Don, is that along the right lines, do you think?
Yeah. I mean, you get suspicious. It literally would have been easier to get it right than to get it as wrong as you get it. It's unbelievable. But, I mean, you can actually give a theoretical defence of it. There's this thing in prosody called dolnik, which is a Russian verse form, which is just like four strong stresses. And that's the sort of basis of so much kind of, you know, sort of accidental poetry. You know, it's just like, And in the dolnik tradition, which, you know, goes through different European cultures and Slavic cultures, you can put as many wee syllables between those big hits as you want. But no one put as many as McGonagall crammed in there. You know, he tests the robustness of the dolnik form, you know, to the nth degree. So from that point of view, he's an innovator, I think, yeah.
See, that's the technical stuff we needed. I wish I'd consulted Don before I'd written my piece.
And that's it for this week. As ever, if you've enjoyed our discussions, why not pick up a copy of the magazine to read all the articles we've spoken about in full? And if you do enjoy the podcast, please do click the follow button to be notified when a new episode is out. I'm William Moore.
And I'm Laura Prendergast, and we hope you join us again next week.